Hey everybody, Jan Rutherford here with Self-Reliant Leadership. Hey, thanks for joining us today. It's 11:30 Pacific time, 2:30 on the East Coast. And I have a very special guest today, Mary Abajay with CareerStone Group. Mary, welcome.
Thank you so much. And it's 2:30 here in DC, the nation's capital. So this is the nice little jolt of energy I need in the afternoon. So great to be here. Thanks for having me, Jan.
Yeah. And it's not even lunchtime here on the West Coast. but Dean Correll is who said you have to have Mary on in office hours, what we call LinkedIn Live. And I'm like, Mary, I don't know Mary. And he goes, Managing Up, the book? I'm like, oh, I know the book. And it's so funny because we were just talking before we went on that I do a lot of executive coaching, and so much of the executive coaching I do has to do with managing sideways and managing up. Most of the executives I work with are pretty darn good at managing their teams, but they get into trouble managing up, managing sideways. So I can't wait to talk about your book. But first, you know, if you could give us a little background and, you know, what you spend most of your time doing with your clients.
Well, so I am the president and the owner of a boutique consulting firm called CareerStone Group, and we do organizational talent and leadership development, but mostly, actually about half and half private sector government. So we get a little mix of both, which is really nice. We do a lot of work with building like cohort leadership programs at all stages of leadership, but primarily we focus on the early and the emerging leaders. So early and mid, when you get up to the senior stuff, we do some stuff around executives, but it's really around that kind of growth period. And our stuff is fun. It's interactive. I have a great team. And our whole mission in life is to help people make really great work lives and workplaces. Because if you're going to spend most of your waking hours at work, those should be really great hours. So we love helping people create and maintain productive and positive work environments. That's what we do. That's our jam.
That's awesome. And before we get into the book and what you do, I'm just curious, when you're not working in the nation's capital, what's something fun?
Okay, I got two speeds, working or slothing. Like I'm either working hard or I'm lying on the couch watching really bad TV. I do, however, because I am an old English major, I love to read and do crossword puzzles. So that's about the most fun that I am. I am a highly functioning introvert. So when I'm not extroverting, I am introverting.
Wow. Have you ever seen a sloth in the wild?
No, what do they do?
They don't do much.
My husband tells me, because he does all this astrology, he tells me I have a hidden beach bum gene in me. And so that's my actual, I work really hard in hopes that someday I can just be a beach bum.
Beach bum. There you go. Well, let's get into it. So the book's called Managing Up. And, you know, I in my mind's eye, it's like, oh, Mary must have had a bad boss or a bad experience. Something triggered this. I mean, what was the genesis of creating this book?
Well, it's really funny because I did have a lot of bad bosses, but that's not why I wrote the book. But having bad bosses was why I decided to create my own company. I figured if I could work for a jerk, I could be my own jerk. Like I didn't need to have to report to a jerk. I'm perfectly capable of acting like a jerk. So the impetus of writing the book was really largely based on our work in consulting and advising clients. And I kept finding all these people complain about their bosses over and over. And the bosses would be complaining about them. And I'm like, people, don't you talk to each other? Like, this is not rocket science. Like, this is not a big deal. And the other thing, which I'm sure you see a lot of with your clients, is people just spin out stories, right? So their boss is difficult. So suddenly their boss is like Godzilla reincarnated, when their boss might just be an introvert. So I thought, you know what? Let's write a book about managing up. And there weren't that many on that subject when I went to write my book. There was a million books on how to manage down, but like there was like eight on how to manage up. So I thought, let's make a practical how-to guide to help people navigate one of the most important relationships in the workplace. And that's the one that you have with your boss. So that was the whole impetus.
It reminds me, looking at a book over here by Lisa McLeod, when she said she told her dad when she was at Procter & Gamble as a young executive that she got promoted. And her boss said, oh, you know, do you realize now you're the second most important person in most of these people's lives? And so we've got people weighing in where they're dialing in from. So keep letting us know in the chat where you're calling in from. We love that. And if you've got questions, please post them in there, and I will do my very best to get those to Mary and post those. So we got people from Colorado and Pennsylvania and Texas and Utah and Alberta. It's awesome.
Well, you know, I love what you said about that, because, you know, one of the kind of silver linings of my book, which I didn't really expect, was how many managers came to me and said, oh my God, I haven't really thought about like how easier or how hard I'm making other people to manage up to me. So that comment that you just said about Lisa, like that is very true. When you are a manager, like you've got to realize like the outsized impression that you're going to have on people and their work life. So I think that's very, very true.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I love, I mean, in the podcast that we do, our tagline is we study leaders. Yeah. And I was just telling my MBA students last night that, you know, what I hope, you know, as we wrap up the semester, that they become lifelong students of leadership in the pursuit of the question, what makes a leader? Because I think that, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, if we had it all figured out, you know, there wouldn't be any bad bosses. We'd all be doing it right if we actually knew what the recipe was. But
part of what you're what you just said, which is so brilliant and important, is that it's a lifelong journey. I mean, leadership is a lifelong learning experience. And all too often people think, what got me here, I'm done, right? When the truth is, you always have to be learning as a leader. The minute you think there's nothing more for you to learn as a leader is the minute that you start becoming a bad leader. And I also love the fact that you said that so many of your executive clients are still struggling with managing up. Because the other thing that happens, I think, as we rise in organizations, we think, oh, I'm all that. I'm here. I've arrived. You know, everyone just needs to like, you know, kowtow to me. But you're always having to manage up to somebody, whether it's a client, whether it's a boss, a board of directors. It's a lifelong thing that people need to, I think that people really need to embrace.
Yeah. I was just on the phone with someone earlier today that really high potential person, super high potential and very humble. And I said to them something that I heard advice as a young salesperson. And that was, some people ask for what they want. Some people take what's given to them. And in other words, you know, you can sit there and say, hey, if you tap me on the shoulder, I'll be there. But, you know, and there's a fine line between, you know, being the squeaky wheel and just sitting there passively, and letting people know, I do want to take on more responsibility. What do you think?
I think that's very true. And I think, you know, part of asking for what you want is about managing your career. And so often, one of the simplest things we teach in our workshops is how to make an effective request. All too often, people either sit by the wayside waiting for someone to notice them or give them what they want or give them what they need, instead of saying, you know what, here's what I'd like to do, and be able to make that into a request that's hearable and actionable by the other person. Such as, if you want to be a leader or manager, go find out what it takes and what you need to do that, right? So I think making effective requests that are in alignment, and of course, an effective request is what it is, why you want it, what it looks like, the benefit for the other person in the organization, and then what you're going to do to make it happen.
Yeah. You know, when I was a CEO, here's my secret. Here's my fantasy. My fantasy first was, nobody's going to drop a big pile of garbage on my desk at 4 on Friday. That was my first fantasy. My second one was that people would come and they would say, hey, Jan, here's the situation, the facts. Here's an option, pros, cons. Here's an option, pros, cons. Here's an option, pros, cons. Here's what I recommend.
Yes.
And so I didn't want people to come in with a solution, because they might not have a broad enough point of view. And what if I didn't like their solution? I wanted them to come with options. But what do you think happens most of the time when we're the boss? What do they bring to us?
They bring a complaint or a problem.
And they just throw it on the desk. So, you know, and again, I don't think that's changed, you know, with the pandemic.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I think so much of that also is us as leaders or bosses or managers, I don't want to use the word training, but really articulating and developing our people to do exactly what you said. Because I agree with you. That is almost universally what most bosses want. Bring me some options. Show me that you've thought about this. Show me that you have some ideas on how to solve this problem more, you know. And I think some of it is we have to coach our people and develop them. It's like, this is really the best strategy to do.
Yeah.
And we can't expect them just to know how to do that.
Well, the other thing is I appreciate it if somebody was coaching me.
Yeah.
And oftentimes they'll say, well, I'm not the boss. I'm like, well, leadership is not a title. Leadership is an activity. You can exhibit influence on people above, below, and sideways. I mean, are you seeing a timidity of people in the workforce that they're afraid to do that? Or are you seeing people being more bold and coaching their boss? Or are they just being more bold in telling their boss what they like and don't like and what should happen and what shouldn't happen?
I think it depends on the boss. I think it depends on the relationship. It depends on the boss. It depends on the person. I will say this, you know, we talk about it in the workshops. I'm not sure if I really put it in the book, but like how to have a conversation with your boss about what matters, about what's important to them. You know, I call this the preferences, the priorities, and the pet peeves conversation. Mm-hmm. So if your boss hasn't had this conversation with you, meaning like, here are my preferences, here's how I like to work, here's are my needs, my wants, blah, 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 then you should have one with your boss. And you'd be shocked at how many people are reluctant to even go have that conversation with their boss. You'd be shocked how many people are reluctant to even go to their boss and say, what are my current priorities? I mean, I'm always stunned by that. I think because people feel if they go to their boss and they're like, you know, I'm not sure what the priorities are, they fear that their boss may think that they're not competent, but that's not true. Your boss, it's their job to always be reaffirming priorities. They want to do that. So I think people are a little hesitant to have these conversations with their boss.
Yeah. Well, and underlying all that is that word that gets bantered about so much, trust.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? So is that a big part of your book and the message you're trying to get out is that at the end of the day, none of this can happen if there isn't a relationship built on some foundation of trust?
Yeah, I mean, that's a little bit about it, but I actually take it even a step before that. Like none of this can happen unless you're willing to actually step into the role of that relationship. So I think I want people to have agency in that relationship with their boss. Mm. I think all too often people think that managing up is sucking up. It's about being a sycophant, a patsy, and that is not it. Managing up is about actually creating, maintaining a productive and positive working relationship with someone who has a lot of influence over your career. And so that means putting yourself in a position where you have agency in that relationship. It's kind of like this. You know how we think about bosses and staff as like a hierarchical paradigm, which it is, but I want people to switch it and look at it as a relationship paradigm. And in a relationship, everybody's got some agency. So how are you using your agency to help create a productive, robust relationship with this person or with any person really in the organization?
And that's what you mean by agency.
Yeah, that's what I mean by agency. Like, don't sit there and just like, well, my boss should, he needs to do this. They ought to be doing this. She should be doing that. Like, they're not. So what are you going to do? Like, if your boss isn't perfect, and guess what, people, most of them aren't. If your boss isn't perfect, don't let your career get derailed. Figure out how to navigate that relationship so that you can be successful, they can be successful, and the organization can be successful. Yeah. It's really about using adaptive relationship strategies, which I'm sure you talk about all the time in your coaching. Like, who is that person? What do they need? What do they want? What are you willing to do more of, less of, or differently to build that relationship?
Yeah. Well, you have the three P's. On our expeditions that we lead, we have the three C's.
What are your C's?
No complaining, no condemning, no criticizing. And what's interesting is when you're in austere conditions, if one person starts condemning, criticizing, complaining, it's a cancer.
It's a cancer. It's your 4C.
Yeah. it just takes the team down. And, you know, again, it's one thing to do it on a quote unquote short expedition. It's another thing to be in the marathon that is the business world. There's times when, you know, we all need to vent. But let me.
And what I always say, like with the complaining, I love that you had, that's one of your three C's. Cause I always say to people, inside of every complaint, there is a request. Find it and make it, right? Because if you can find that request, that's where your agency begins, to ask for something that you need, ask for something that's different.
Oh, I like that. I like that.
You can have it. I probably stole from somebody.
Well, again, this goes back to the other part in building a trusting relationship or anything is, you know, using these is what you're talking about is, you know, not just hearing, but listening. I mean, really, really listening. You know, you've identified seven bosses in your book, which is really cool. And if it's okay, I kind of want to go through each one of them. And I would love for the people listening, if they've got a story or a question related to these, to pipe in. And I'll give you the seven real quick, and then we'll go dive in one by one. Boss from hell, ghost boss, impulsive, micromanager, narcissist, pushover, workaholic. And we all know that there's bosses that are more than one of those.
Yeah. Well, the combos. Yeah.
Yeah. The combos. But let's start with the boss from hell.
Okay.
You know, who is he or she? How do we identify boss from hell? And what do we do about them?
Yeah. So, and I'm glad you asked that question, because the other ones you mentioned, we are what we call difficult bosses. Like, they're difficult. But the boss from hell, what I'm talking about there is the truly toxic boss, the boss that's the truly terrible, the boss that does make your life a living nightmare. And this is not just a boss that's difficult. This is a boss that's probably a toxic person, a gaslighter, a gaslighter, an extreme narcissist, if you will, sometimes. The bosses that rule by abusing, degrading, debasing people. A boss that I actually think is probably not a good person. And when you have, you know, this is the boss that really just decimates your psychological health, your emotional health, and your physical health. And the thing people need to know, if they're working for a toxic boss, is chances are nobody's coming to save you, right? Mm-hmm. HR probably ain't coming to save you. They may want to save you. They may not have the power to save you. All too often, these toxic bosses sit at the top of organizations, right? Or they're what we call the brilliant jerks, and organizations don't really get rid of the people that, you know, are making the rain, right? So if you have a toxic boss, I really want you to think about how you can get yourself out. If you work for a toxic boss or a toxic culture, you have a dramatically increased risk of heart disease, stroke, and a whole, 60%. There have been study after study about the deleterious effects of working in a toxic culture. Your immune system gets decimated, your emotional system gets decimated, and it can take up to, are you ready for this? Up to 2 years to fully recover from the impacts of working for a toxic boss. The mental health professionals compare it to post-traumatic stress syndrome and better spouse syndrome. So if you find yourself in a toxic situation, my advice really is to just get yourself out, do what you can.
Wow.
And now is a great time, because there's a war for talent. So I don't think anyone should have to work for the hands of a toxic boss.
Well, you know, I in my mind's eye, I can think of a few bosses that fit this category, and they are at the CEO level.
Yeah.
They are not frontline manager. Let me throw a comment up here. And it's Abisoy, as collaborative and emphatic leader myself, I tend to bring in conversations around making decisions just because that's who I am. How do I be me with a collaborative approach and still give my boss the confidence that I'm capable of making sound decisions as a leader? Great question.
That's a great question. All right. Do you want me to take a stab at it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So first of all, how you manage up might be different than how you manage down. So it sounds like you're a consensus. Sounds like you're a consensus driven leader yourself, getting other people's opinions, caring about them, caring about the impact of your decisions on other people. If your boss is a consensus making decision, then when you are sharing your decisions or your processes, then you want to illustrate, here's how I'm doing this. If your boss is more like me, which is just make any damn decision and make it fast, then make sure you're giving your boss a timeline. Okay, I'm going to have this decision by this date and by this date. You don't necessarily need to go into your process, but keep to a timeline. So find out what's important to your boss in terms of their decision-making process. If your boss is somebody who is like a C on the disc or a very, in my book, I call it the evaluator, someone that likes a lot of process and a lot of details, when you show your decision methodology to that boss, then you want to show all the facts and figures that you've done. So you want to figure out like what's your boss's decision-making jam, and then align in, at least in your expression of your decisions to their, meet their needs, if that made sense. So basically like craft what you did and give it in the language that they can understand.
Know your audience. Great. And again, we appreciate the question and we welcome more. Let me move on from Boss from Hell. That kind of a close one to that is the narcissist. Did I just get you excited about talking about narcissism?
All right. So first of all, narcissism, like anything, is a spectrum, right? So a little bit of narcissism, probably very doable. Medium amount of narcissism might be doable too for a while. But when you're getting to the extreme narcissism, that's going to border on toxicity. So a couple of things. First of all, you even though I always tell you, like, managing up isn't about sucking up, it's not about being a sycophant, this is the exception that proves the rule. So if you are working for a narcissist, you are going to have to do a little bit of ego fluffing. That's just the way it is. That is what they respond to. So you have to decide right from the beginning, is it worth it? Is it worth it to work for a narcissist? Here's the thing. Narcissists can be, and usually are, often very successful people. They're often also very charming people. So you may not have realized that you said yes to the dress until you're already working for that person. So you want to learn what you can when you're working for a narcissist. I don't want to turn you into a sycophant. So if you can find some things that you genuinely do appreciate about that person, keep those positive comments to that. The other thing I want you to do is to really, I want you to learn what you can and then get out if the narcissism gets bad, but you're going to want to protect your self-esteem and you're going to want to protect your professional image. So your self-esteem, what I mean by this is narcissists often raise themselves up by lowering others down. So you can't let any of that poison get into you. Like, don't let them do a number on your ego. But you also want to make sure that other people don't see you as just a sycophant. So you've got to work to make sure that you still stay a strong-minded, independent thinker with your colleagues and in front of your boss to the best that you can, so that other people just don't think you're a suck up. So those are just a couple of ideas for the narcissist. And Jan, I'm sure you've got, I'm sure you've run through it one or two before.
Well, you know, they're tough. I mean, oftentimes they're brilliant.
Yep.
They get things done. I mean, we can think of some of these people that fit the bill in the public realm, you know, both on the political spectrum and the business. But you know, they're hard to work for. And again, it kind of goes back to, I think it comes at a cost to you.
Yeah.
So I think your counsel is really good. We got another question came in from Diana. Can you talk about establishing agency when you first join a new team? How does one ensure that they maintain a solid relationship and alignment from the get-go so that they receive the proper coaching and growth opportunities to do their best work? Great question.
All right. So Diana, here's what I want you to do. When you, about a couple of weeks after you join the team, like get your feel around of everybody, I want you to go have the preferences, priorities, and pet peeves conversation with your boss. And if you email or find Jen or I on LinkedIn, I will send you a list of questions. And this is where you're just going to have this meeting and you're going to be, yo, boss person, who's successful with you? What are your preferences around communicating? What are your pet peeves around virtual work or whatever? I have a whole list of questions. And what this is going to do is going to do two things for you. One is you're going to learn very quickly what your boss likes or doesn't like. Two, your boss is going to be like, well, look at you, Diana, like caring about what I think about. They're going to love it. And three, hopefully that will inspire your boss to turn around and ask you the same questions. If they don't worry. At least you're getting what you need in order to build the relationship with them. I teach this all the time. And, you know, since the book came out, I've been fortunate enough to talk to probably like 200,000 people. And I always ask the bosses, how many of you have ever had an employee have this conversation with you, like initiate it? And I'm up to like 25 out of like 100,000 people. And every one of these bosses have said the employee that initiated this conversation has turned out to be one of my best employees ever. So go have the conversation. Find me on LinkedIn and I will send you the conversation template. It's magic.
Wow. Thanks. Thanks, Mary. And thanks, Diana, for a great question. Let me, so we talked about the boss from hell. We talked about the narcissist. This is the one that makes me smile because, you know, it sounds funny, but I think I know where you're going to go with this because it can be really damaging, is the ghost boss.
Yeah. I love the ghost boss. It's one of my favorite bosses, probably because my team will tell you I kind of am a ghost boss. So the ghost boss, everybody, is the ghost boss, is the type of boss that just, they might give you an assignment and then poof, they disappear. And they're nowhere to be found. You can't get them to weigh in on a decision. They're not there to support you. And you kind of feel like you're out in the ether all by yourself. So the first thing you want to realize when you have a ghost boss is people ghost for a lot of different reasons. They might ghost because they're excessively introverted. They might ghost because they have way too much on their plate and they may want to help you, but they don't have time. They might ghost you because they're macro managers, right? They're people that like, Jan, I hired you. You know what you're doing. You don't need me. And of course they might ghost on you because they might be a little retired in place. So don't assume anything when you start working with the ghost boss. So a couple of tips. One is you're going to have to track them down. You're going to have to be proactive about getting on their calendar. Yes, they may cancel half those meetings. I get it. Be proactive. When you do get their time, be like, sortie it, like be succinct, get in, get out, get what you need. And when you're trying to get their time, make sure you're really clear. Jan, I need 5 minutes of your time to talk about ABC. Bam. And then just use that 5 minutes to talk about ABC and then get out. You do want to keep them in the loop on your projects. Just because they're ghosting you doesn't mean you can ghost them. And then there's two more quick tips I'll give you. One is called FITFO. And FITFO is an old Army term, that's an acronym for figure it the F word out, which means you're going to have to really rely on colleagues, your own agencies, like to really figure out what you need to do. And then the second one around that is a little CYA, a little cover your arse, if you will. And this is really about saying something like, creating a little email trail. So let's say I needed Jan's input on a report I was doing. I would email Jan and be like, yo, Jan. I mean, I wouldn't say yo, Jan. I'd be like, dearest Jan. yo, Jan, I am filing the Penske report Friday at 5 o'clock. Let me know if you have any input for it by 4 o'clock. Other words, I'll just assume it's good to go. Thanks so much, Mary. So just a little covering of your behind is very, very helpful. And the last thing I'll say is this. Your ghost boss probably isn't going to be the best mentor or the best person for professional development. So seek out someone like a Jan or someone else in your organization to help give you that sort of career development, career path and conversations.
Yeah. And the thing, Mary, I would add this, and I just happen to know this offhand from the Gallup organization, 25% of people feel they're ignored by their boss. And that, and this is pre-pandemic, results in 40% disengagement.
Yeah.
So if you're a ghost boss, you might think, hey, I'm busy, I don't have the time. People need you. I mean, your time with people is a gift.
Yeah.
Provided you're an average or above average boss. And being ignored is not okay.
Yeah, people don't feel valued. They don't feel heard. Right. And we'll have to edit this out so my team doesn't see it, because they'll just use it as fodder against me. No, but you are so right, Jan. And it doesn't take that much, bosses. It just takes a little bit of, you know, 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, a little check-in so people feel valued, they feel cared about, they feel heard and seen.
Couple of questions before we get on with the other ones. And we could maybe go through these pretty quick. And Imran sent me a note and said he meant priorities. of my boss and mine are not matching. What do I want? He can't give what he wants. I don't want to give. What do I do?
Well, you leave. I'm sorry, Ron. I'm very kind of direct. Okay, so sometimes relationships don't work out. So I don't say you should just up and say, you know, I'm out of 5,000. But like, if you and your boss are not in alignment about priorities, if you're not in alignment about what good work looks like or what kind, then I really recommend that you put yourself into a better situation, a situation where you can excel, where you can thrive. All too often, we fall prey to the economic fallacy of opportunity costs, right? Where we think we're the sunk cost. First of all, I put so much time in here, blah, 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 blah. Well, that's great, but you're not getting that time back. And what you're losing is opportunity cost, which is what are you missing? What are you saying no to by not putting yourself in a situation where you can thrive? So if you really can't make the relationship work, look for another situation, whether it's internal in your organization or in another organization. That would be my advice. What do you say, Chad?
I agree with you 100%, Mary, 100%. Another question before we move on. Ashanti, any advice on working with peers that typically don't pull their weight? I'm laughing because this is so familiar. But projects still need to get done regardless. This is the MBA student creed. You know, I'm the only one doing my work on the project, but it happens in the business world.
Well, I would say you got a couple of choices. One, you can go have a direct conversation with these team members saying, hey, yo, you're not like, we had an agreement that we were all going to do this. And I'm not seeing this from you. And here's the impact it's having on me. So a classic sort of accountability feedback conversation with your colleagues. That's really what you should do in the very, very beginning. And that's the first thing you should, that's your first option. If that doesn't work, you have the option of ratting them out. Like you have the option of escalating. I'm not necessarily saying you should do that, but I think you should always handle the problem at its source first. The other thing I want you can think about doing is that when you're working on a project, where you're kicking off a project, make it clear what everybody's roles and responsibilities are and what that looks like. Create some ground rules. Do like a RACIC chart, roles, authority, responsibilities, and have the conversation with your teammates. How are we going to handle it when one of us or some of us can't meet our deadlines or we're running late on deadlines and things like that? So if you can start at the beginning, having those accountability like parameter set, then when you have to have the accountability conversations, it can work so that your last, very, very last resort would be escalation. And what would you say, Jan?
If you bring somebody else in, you've damaged the relationship. Mm-hmm. You've got to figure out how to solve that. And again, sometimes when we look at it, it's not, you know, the thing that would make it better is, and this is what I advocate for, is you create a group alignment at the beginning. Yeah. You say, hey, here's our common goal. You know, again, any team has common purpose and trust. And then you say, hey, here's our strengths. Here's our weaknesses. Here's how I communicate. Here's how I don't. Where do we think we're going to have conflict, potential conflict? And if we do, let's assume we're going to, what are we going to do to mitigate it? If you have that conversation up front, it's a lot easier to say, hey, dude, do that. You know, put your hand figuratively on their shoulder, not literally, and say, man, you're letting me down, the team down, yourself down. You said you're going to do it. You didn't do it. Come on.
Yeah.
That is the way to go. And so I think part of it is if you're stuck there and you're like, I'm going to have to do it, is well, at least learn something from it and don't make that same mistake in forward. Teams that come together real quick and start working right away always have dysfunction. The teams that basically say, we're going to slow down before we speed up, we're going to go really, really slow and get things right, I think do much better.
Yeah, I completely agree.
I'm glad we're in agreement. Let me go to, next to the ghost boss, I've got the pushover.
So the pushover is the kind of boss that can be really frustrating. The pushover is the kind of boss that's constantly changing their mind because somebody else, like, you know, constantly changing their mind based on what the last person just said to them. Like, they won't make a decision, and then they make a decision, they're kind of wishy-washy. They're like, oh, well, Mary just said we'll do this, so we're going to do that. Oh, wait, Jen, we should do that. Okay, let's do that. They don't stick up for you. They don't have any backbone or spine. And it might be because they're new at the job. It might be because they're a big people pleaser. It might be that they're afraid to make decisions, or they just may be wishy-washy. So if you have a pushover boss, you know, you're not going to change who they are, but you can help build a little backbone for them. So you want to make sure that you, first of all, you pay attention to, like, who's telling them what, and like who these people are, so that you can kind of navigate that as well. Giving them some really strong research or some strong reasoning for their decisions so they can, like, really stick there. So doing a little more legwork for them so they can feel more confident. Being that kind of person that maybe brainstorms all the different pros and cons of their different kind of decisions, like being that trusted advisor or counselor, so that once you can kind of coach them in to the right decision, they'll stick with it. And sometimes it'll take a little bit of, like, work around the team, like get your team involved and come with a team recommendation. So those are a couple of thoughts. Jen, what would you do with a pushover?
Yeah, I think it's important for them to understand that, you know, again, here's where I would coach the boss is,
yeah,
you know what? Hey, boss, we all want to be on an A team. And, you know, part of your job is to uphold the standards. If somebody's not living up to it, there should be consequences. Yeah. I mean, you know, I know you want to be the coach, but sometimes, boss, you got to be the umpire. Yeah. You got to call balls and strikes. So that's what I would help them understand is why it's so important is because the A players want to work on an A team.
Yeah.
And they don't want, right. And the other thing is that if they're a pushover with the team, they might be a pushover with their peers and not be clearing obstacles or providing resources that the team needs. So I think a pushover boss can be tough. I know there's people that like to work for them because then they feel like they can boss them around. But if you're working for a weak player, it's going to be hard for you to have as much power and influence in the organization.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, yeah, I think that's right. Unless you're going to get all Machiavelli and, like, use that weakness to, like, promote yourself, but it can be very, very challenging.
Yeah. By the way, in the comments, Ashante and Imran are thanking you for your responses. I want to put kind of a long one here from Mitch Chesney. Interesting situation where the CEO gave a directive that was not going to move the needle or impact the business in any meaningful way, and executing its directive more critical and time-sensitive projects, people in business need to be scrapped. How would you manage up, or what conversations would you have to the senior leader who was disconnected with the impact of his misguidance and was having in trust in his leadership team more?
Oh, Mitch. Okay, so I would kind of need to know where you are in the organization. So if you are part of the senior leader team, where you have your sphere of influence is a little bit closer, then a direct conversation needs to be had. But you would want to really go into the conversation. Of course, all of this, everybody, really depends on the personalities involved, the type of people they're dealing with, how open they are to feedback, understanding. So first of all, I would try to understand, like, why was this initiative too important to the CEO? What was it that they were trying to accomplish? And when you can find out that, then you can say, oh, I get it. And tell me more about using this strategy to get that. And then you could do some, like, have you considered we could possibly do this, that, or that? You know, you could actually then bring in some other strategies. It's like what Jen and I were talking about before we came on. When people bring us options, we love options. Like, give them some other options. If you're not part of that senior team, if you're a step below that, you could talk to your manager and say, help me understand why we're doing that. I always start with trying to understand the reasoning behind something, because he may have had to do it because a board of directors may have told him to do it. And then what you want to do is have conversations about how we can mitigate if we have to go on this direction. How are we going to mitigate, you know, the damage done by pulling resources? There are some times in an organization where leaders will make bad decisions and they will throw away resources. Sometimes we fight depending on how important it is. Like we stick up, speak truth to power. And sometimes we have to just kind of suck it up. We're not sucking up to them, but sometimes people have to make a mistake for them to learn. So this is kind of always a challenging situation. I was working with a young lawyer once. I was doing a workshop and this first year lawyer came to me and said, "Mary, the senior partner refuses to use an Oxford comma. How can I tell them that this is just wrong and that he has to change his ways?" And I was like, "Little dude, do not die on the hill of the Oxford comma. Like that is not going to take, that's not taking the law firm down, you know." So sometimes we have to pick and choose our battles. I don't know. What would you say, Jan?
You know, I like your comment about, you know, you've got to understand the leader's point of view. And no matter what, you will not have the leader's point of view if you're not the leader. It's kind of like the person in the fire tower looking over the forest. They're going to see something that you can't see from the ground. I will tell you this too. When you become a CEO, and no matter how ready you are, it feels like that you've put on a 120-pound backpack that you never get to take off. And it's relentless. And everything is personal. All the shoulds and shouldn'ts that you hear as a CEO are all personal. They are personal, personal, personal. So, you know, it's easy, you know, it's really easy. And again, from this chair and all the other chairs to armchair quarterback. So again, you're hearing a little bit of my bias toward the leader, but I think it, you know, again, if you want to influence people, you have to know where they're coming from.
Yeah.
So.
I love it. Great question, Mitch. Let's know how that turns out.
Let's I like this one. Before we go on, we've got three more. We're running out of time, but I love this question. not that you've never heard this one. How do you handle a boss who throws his team under the bus?
Well, Krishna, this is easy. First of all, be sure you are being thrown under the bus. Like if you're sure your boss is throwing you under the bus at the first sign of trouble, you leave that boss. I mean, bam, bottom line, like you're not gonna, like that is just unacceptable. I mean, if you use any, like maybe don't leave today, maybe don't go out in a hail of FUs, but if your boss doesn't stand up for you, if your boss isn't the kind of boss that's going to take the heat, then they're not the best boss and you can do better. What do you say, Jan?
Totally agree. I mean, life's too short. We all
life's
know.
Life's too that. Short. You're and, too talented.
And
yeah.
It's an employee market right now.
Yes, it is.
So let's talk about, we got impulsive workaholic micromanager. Let's kind of go through these a little bit more quickly. Okay. Impulsive.
Whether you like it or not, it's going to be your job to manage all that frantic, cray-cray energy from your impulsive boss into something doable and feasible. And just so everybody knows, the impulsive boss is the one that's always chasing shiny objects and shifting priorities. Let's do this. Squirrel, squirrel, squirrel. So what you want to be able to do is find like the kernel or the germ, the nugget of what it is they're trying to accomplish and see if you can latch onto that. A new office on Mars? Don't think we can do that. How about Toledo? Would Toledo work for you? Like something doable. It's a better team sport than individual sport. The other thing is you want to use the yes and in order to have them clarify priorities and things like that. So it looked like this. Jan, that's an interesting idea. And what other projects do you want to drop to do that? Jan, that's an interesting idea. Which resources do you want to pull from these other priorities to accomplish that? Jan, that's a really cool idea. And here's what are going to be our challenges in getting it fixed. So you're always like bringing them down, putting guardrails around their impulsivity. My last tip for the impulsive boss is this: just don't do anything. Just wait till they ask you a second or third time. I mean, you have to know your boss, but it's, you know, they can be really great bosses because you might do some cool stuff. You've got to figure out what kind of guardrails work.
Yeah. I love what you said at the end because, you know, I'm smiling in my mind's eye. I know this guy is like, yep, I write down what X person says and I just smile. And then I don't do anything because I know, and then I'm going to add something. And he has this, you know, a book that he keeps all those things in and the boss never follows up on it. And it's like, I'm glad I didn't go chasing that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Cause they'll drive you crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. That's literally, you know, when I think of managing your boss, I think of, you know, managing the impulsive boss. You know, All right. So next one is the workaholic. And I remember as a young lieutenant, you know, they in the Army, they said, whatever you do, don't work for a bachelor. They're all workaholics.
First of all, you should know whether you're working for a workaholic before, again, you say yes to the dress. Workaholics tend to be pretty honest about being a workaholic. They say things like, oh, we don't keep regular hours, workaholic. Oh, we work hard and play hard, workaholic. So make sure you know this. A couple of things with a workaholic, and I am one. You want to be really clear about your boundaries and their request. Your boundaries are when you are and aren't available or willing to work past like regular work hours. So be clear, be tactful, be transparent about your boundaries. Also, be really clear about what their after hours requests really mean. A lot of bosses will just send off emails as they're cleaning off their plate. And they may not even mean for you to answer them. And I know, they should learn how to do their emails so they don't do that. But you can't change who they are. So make sure you understand what those requests mean. The other thing with workaholics is you really do have to focus on output, output, output. It's a game every day. That's what workaholics care about. So make sure they know how productive you are being. And then my last little mini tip on workaholics is this. Every now and then, you should consider going the extra mile. Every now and then, you should consider giving an extra hour, an extra day, a little extra something, something, because your workaholic boss will always appreciate that. And it may not be as much as you think it is. It could just be like one extra couple of late nights a month or a quarter. Maintain your boundaries, but every now and then, because your workaholic boss is going to love the person that works a little bit harder now and then than the one that doesn't. So those are just a couple tips for the workaholic, but mostly know what you're getting into. And there are some fields like lawyers, accountants, consultants, that's a very workaholic sort of field. So,
yeah. Well, this is the one as a boss I can relate to the most. I mean, I have balance in my life and I do all kinds of things, but I work really hard. And the word I would use, just so everybody knows, I would be very upfront about this, is I want people that are very responsive.
Yeah.
That's another word that basically says demanding. You know, a lot of, you know, I expect, you know, and part of it is because I'm so passionate about what I do. I mean, I love what I do. I know it helps people and it's intertwined with my life. That's not for everybody. Yeah. And it, again, if it's not for you, I say, you know, you're clear, because, you know, it will be a very demanding environment. And a lot of people don't want that these days. And that's okay. You know, just be clear about what you want. Somebody wrote, Diana wrote, workaholic bosses are everywhere at Microsoft. Don't tell me that.
Microsoft. Oh my gosh, Diana, I've been doing some things for Microsoft and for their lawyer groups and stuff. And I love them because we are emailing each other on Saturdays and Sundays. So for me, they're like my perfect client, but yeah, it can be hard if that's not your shtick.
All right. So the last one, and then we'll wrap up. And this one, I always do a case study with my MBA students on micromanagement. So the micromanager, and again, if you ever ask somebody in an interview, tell me about the best boss, people always say, not a micromanager, you know, stay in their lane. Nobody wants a micromanager. Yet, I think this is the most common.
It is. It's the most common. It's the one that people hate the most. And you know what? The reason why it's so troublesome and irksome is because this really taps into neuropsychological needs. Like, so we all have a neuropsychological need for autonomy, to be have our own agency and do our own thing. And some people, well, everybody also has a neuropsychological need for certainty. And some people have a higher need. So your micromanager's higher need for certainty is always going to trump your autonomy or step on it until they get their certainty. So if you have a micromanager, first of all, don't take it personally. It may not be about you. It might be about their need for certainty. Unless, however, you are the only person that is being micromanaged, then you need to take that very personally, because it is about you. There's something you are not doing or giving them. Micromanagers need more information, a little bit more inclusion, and a little more control than other people. It is not fair. It is not right, but that's who they are. So what you have to do is you have to over-communicate with them. You have to flood them with information. You have to include them a little bit more in the beginning of the project until they get the trust going with you. It's going to take extra effort. You're going to hate every second of it. But the thing is, once you meet that threshold of trust, most of the time they will let go, but they're not going to let go until you build the trust. So you're in a catch 22. Over-communicate, flood them with information before they ask, find out about what they are nitpicky about, and just like say, here's what I'm going to do, X, Y, Z, and check in with them until you build that trust. It's no fun, but it's very doable.
Mary, thank you. Here's what I'm hearing. Tell me if you think this is a decent summary, and please, you know, be brutally honest. I mean, here's what I'm hearing. I'm an employee. I have an agenda. I think the company should be doing these things. I think these are the priorities. Here's how I want to do it. Here's the relationship I want. Here's the communication I want. Over here, the boss has an agenda with all the same stuff on it. And it might be the same. It might be different. And chances are, managing up, it's different. And so what I think the smart person does is figure out, I have an agenda, the boss has an agenda. How do I hold both these in my mind at once to get what I want that I know that's best for the organization? Where do I give? Where do I take? Where do I compromise? You know, like you said, you know, what do I want to, you know, pick your battles, you know, don't die on the Oxford comma type of thing. But that to me, I mean, is that the essence?
Yeah. That's the essence. You know, you can't get to your agenda until they get some of their agenda. And you've got to build a partnership. And somebody asked earlier in the comments, like, how do I manage my boss? You're not managing your boss. You're managing the relationship. And that's what people really need to know. It's about a relationship. Once you can build that robust, productive, positive relationship, and you show that you care about their agenda, then you start doing your agenda as well. You're finding ways to align them. Sometimes you have to let go of yours a little bit, sometimes not. So I think the way you said it was beautiful.
Yeah. And one last comment, and then I'll let you gather your thoughts on what I'd like you to put out as a challenge. But Ashante came back and said, I've learned about my current boss, not taking it personal allowed for more conversations to get the root issues she was having and what I could do to meet that need. It was a win-win for both of us. Awesome. Isn't that cool?
Love.
So Mary, you know, I said my piece about the agenda. I would love for you to have the last word today and, you know, kind of putting a bow on this. And again, what you, you know, what the charge is, you know, for folks going forward. And again, to all of you listening in, this has been great, great interaction, conversation. And I put Mary's web address in there so you can connect with her on LinkedIn. You've got her web address. You've got my web address. You know, we're both LinkedIn learning instructors with a bunch of courses out there. So, you know, feel free to follow us, contact us, whatever we can do to help point resources in the right way. But and buy Mary's book, Managing Up. Mary, the floor is yours.
Here's what I'm going to say, people. You spend most of your waking hours at work. Those should be really great hours. Hours where you get to be creative. Hours where you get to use your passion. Hours where you get to use your brain. And part of that great experience in the workplace is going to be having a good relationship with your boss. Whether we like it or not, our bosses have a lot of influence over our career trajectory. And so when you manage that relationship, when you manage it into something helpful and good for you, for them, for the organization, good things come your way. You cannot change who they are. Your power lies in your ability to either ask for what you need from them or to figure out how you can adapt your interaction styles with them so that you can succeed, they can succeed, and the organization can succeed. It really is about finding where your agency is to create that relationship so that you can have a happy and productive work life, which, by the way, might also give you a happy and productive personal life as well, because we take that stuff home with us. So I really want people to use Managing Up to become career victors and not career victims.
Awesome. Mary, thank you. This was wonderful. Happy holidays to you. Happy holidays to everybody out there. Peace on earth. And I hope to see you in person in 2022.